You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Our guest today is Eric Freifogel. He's an author and a conservationist. And he says a culture writes its name on land for all to see. The land, he says, reflects what we've done, who we are, what we understand, what we value, what we dream. In his new book, Agrarianism and the Good Society, Land, Culture, Conflict, and Hope, he looks at the landscapes of the earth and argues for a new environmental orientation, one that respects and cares for land. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. We look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Eric Freifogel is a professor of law and an affiliate professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written a great deal about the connections between people and place in works such as Why Conservation is Failing and How It Can Regain Ground. His new book, Agrarianism and the Good Society, is published by the University Press of Kentucky. It's the first in a planned series of books from Kentucky on the new agrarianism. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Eric Freifogel, good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm just fine.
Well, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
One of the things that you say in your introduction that I'd like you to talk about here at the outset is this. When we talk about what's wrong, we tend to talk about environmental problems. What's the implication of using that language?
I think one of the implications is that we tend to think that there's something wrong with nature itself. There's something wrong with the land, and it needs to be fixed. And we focus our attention on the physical world. And, of course, we do need to study nature. We need to understand it. But there really is nothing fundamentally wrong with planet Earth. It's not as if we got issued a second-rate planet and we should take it back to the planet store and trade it in for a better model. I mean, our problems, all of our environmental problems, fundamentally are about the ways we live on land. I mean, they are problems fundamentally about human behavior. And therefore, we need to ask ourselves, what are we doing wrong? What could we doing better? We be doing better? And really, why are we acting the way we do? Why do we interact with nature as we do? And I think that, to start at that point and head in that direction, leads to a much different understanding of what our true environmental problems are, as opposed to the more superficial symptoms.
Yeah. One of the essays in this book is written in the form of an employment opportunity.
Yeah.
The chapter is, or the essay is titled, Wanted, an Environmental Leader.
Right.
What do we need?
I might back up and say that that chapter went through a lot of different versions. I started off writing something about environmental studies and what I thought a true, well-grounded environmental studies program at a university might focus on. And it just got too long and cumbersome, and I'm sort of losing interest in it, so I tried to think of an approach that might be a little more clever and lively, and I came up with what you've just described, this want ad for an environmental leader. It seems to me fundamentally that if we're going to get right with nature, if we're going to improve our ways of living, we have to have environmental leaders who can talk about the big picture of our interactions with nature, particularly in cultural terms, the ways we see the lands, the way we evaluate it. Somebody who can understand how our sort of inherited presumptions about nature and our role as conquerors, our tendency to commodify and fragment the land, have all permeated our institutions, and so much so that we take them for granted, the institution of private property, our tendency to divide the land into political jurisdictions, the sort of rectangular grid system that we put on the land and that very much affects our thinking, our individualism, our senses of equality and liberty, all of these cultural ideals, which have wonderful aspects to them, of course, all have downsides when it comes to our interaction with the land. And what we need are intellectual leaders, really, who can talk better about the big picture, who can offer a compelling, appealing vision of living better on the land. And right now, I don't think we have them. And right now, I think our understandings of environmental problems or land use problems generally are much more narrow than they ought to be.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that we have seen a lessening in the interest, if that's a fair way to put it? Maybe I'm all wet here. Maybe it's not interest, but it seems that the environment, ecology, the land, wilderness, natural areas, they're kind of off. They're on the back burner.
Oh, indeed they are. You are not off base there at all. Here would be my explanation of that, and I do take it up, you may remember, in the final chapter of this book.
Mm-hmm.
I think the main problem is that the conservation movement itself is falling down on the job. It is so fragmented among organizations. It has no way of speaking with any sort of unified voice. It has no message for the American people collectively. It also has no way of responding to criticisms of the movement. And I think that people today support environmental protection, but they are uneasy about what the implications of it would be, because they have heard from critics now year after year after year that the steps we would take to protect the environment might infringe with private property, they would interfere with liberty, they're going to be very costly economically, they might be undemocratic, we're going to be treating landowners unequally, so there's sort of the equality issues here. People are concerned about the cultural and economic costs because critics have hit them hard and told them that the costs are out there. So I think the common response of people is, well, yes, I care about the environment, but I also care about all these other things, and we need some sort of balance between the two. I think that's unfortunate because I think the criticisms are not well-grounded. But again, I would trace it back to the inability of the conservation movement collectively to respond to them or to have any spokesman. I think if you stop people on the street and said, what are these blankety-blank environmentalists up to, people would have no idea, because there is just they might be able to point to particular programs or issues, and certainly global climate change at the moment might well be one of them. But what does it all add up to? When critics say environmentalists are protecting nature from people, what does the environmental side have to say about that? Because it frankly is very, very untrue. Environmental protection interferes with private property rights. That's what we hear. What does the environmental side have to say? Again, the answer is nothing, because it has no way of talking. And I think that's a fundamental problem. And unless it changes, I don't see a lot of hope for dealing with many of our most serious land use issues, which have to do with the landscapes where we live. It's not wilderness areas. It's the landscapes like central Illinois, where we live and draw sustenance, and we ought to be using them better than we are.
Yeah. Well, you have the floor now. What should the environmental folks be saying in answer?
Yes.
In answer to
sure,
those.
Sure. That's a wonderful invitation you've given me here. I think to begin with, the environmental movement needs first of all to offer some sort of overall goal for its efforts. If conservation succeeded, what would success look like? If we really did the things we need to do to address our environmental problems, what might our landscapes look like? That's a hard question to answer because nature is complex. We have to take into account its ecological functioning. The ecological functioning, in turn, is very much intertwined with the kind of biological parts that are present, all the plants and animals and hydrologic processes and nutrient flows. I mean, it all gets pretty complicated fairly quickly. And I think the core of the environmental movement would be to synthesize that into some sort of vision of healthy landscapes with people living on them. We need a vision of people integrated in the lands so that we live in a place along with all the soils and rocks and waters, plants and animals in an integrated system. And we're living in ways that we can sustain for generation upon generation upon generation, ways that protect the soil's fertility, that keep it in place, that keep the land productive, that keep it a healthy, beautiful place to live. There have been some efforts over the years to try to distill this down into some sort of a simple message. In some of my writings, and again in this book, I often refer to some of the work of the conservation writer Aldo Leopold, who lived about 50 years ago. He came up with this overall conservation vision that he called land health. Anyway, we need to do better than notions of sustainability or sustainable development, which have been sort of the common terms out there. They don't have much meaning to them, I don't think, nor are they very inspiring. So we need some sort of overall vision of people living on land. And we need then to have some sense about what it would take for us to achieve that vision, how we might reformulate some of our institutions. I, in my own writing, and in this book as well, tend to talk a lot about the institution of private property in land, in nature. I'm a big fan of private property. I think we need to support it. But private property is a very flexible institution, and we can redefine the rights and responsibilities of ownership in a wide variety of ways. And I think that that is an institution that is crying out now for reconsideration. And I think the conservation movement, if it had its act together, would be coming forward with some new ideas about private property, the ways we can conceive it. I mean, it's a big issue in parts of the country, as you probably know, the private property initiatives on various Western ballots in front of Congress at the time. There is a private property movement out there which is putting forth one particular vision of what land ownership is all about. I wish the conservation movement were able to step up and offer an alternative, because it certainly is possible to formulate alternatives which are vastly better suited for the needs of America in the year 2007.
What? Give us an example of what an alternative might be.
Well, I think that one principle that many people embrace is the idea that landowners should not use their land in ways that are harmful. Sort of a do-no-harm rule that's been around literally for centuries. All right, what should the term harm mean? What should land use harm mean in the year 2007 when we are concerned about ecological degradation in a way that our ancestors would not? Should we be redefining land use harm in ways that take into account ecological degradation? Should, for instance, a farmer, I mean, we get lots of farmland, should you have as one of your rights of ownership the right to farm your land in a way that leads to soil erosion? That would be a legitimate question. Should landowners have some obligation to leave some room for wildlife on their lands, for instance? Should you be able to remove trees or vegetation along riparian waterways? I offer these just as a few illustrations. Another issue that I think ought to be on the table is whether or not the rights of landowners to use their land intensively, to develop it in some sense, should they be based upon the land's natural features? Should we be saying to landowners today, listen, if you want to start a new land use, you need to find land for which your use is ecologically well-suited? And we are sort of inching in that direction, although we're not articulating it as a general principle. We are saying to people, you can't build on wetlands, you can't build floodplains, you can't build on barrier islands or on unstable slopes and so on. I mean, I wish we could sort of generalize and turn this into a reformulation of what ownership is about, and that is that your rights to land are not going to be defined in the abstract as we have traditionally thought about them. They're going to be based upon the land's natural features. And I think that the basic principle there, one, is one that might apply more broadly, that we need to be living in ways that are more sensitive to the local lands and landscapes. And our institutions need to take nature into account far more than they do. And I could give other illustrations of that, but maybe I've made my point.
Yeah. A moment or two ago, you talked about fragmentation in terms of the conservationist. But fragmentation is going on across this whole issue, even in terms of how we think of land. When did American attitudes about land as real estate, as property, begin to take shape? And when and how did we begin to see natural areas as places set aside for recreation and contemplation, that kind of thing?
The idea of setting land aside for recreation and contemplation was very much a 19th century idea. There are some earlier examples of it, particularly on private land in England. I mean, that's probably the examples I know the best. It was a late 19th century phenomenon, very much wrapped up in the Romanticism movement, but also just the sense that, you know, these wild areas had been taken for granted. They were rapidly disappearing. Wouldn't it be a nice thing for us to hold on to them? The movement, by the way, to set aside all of these areas for generations was based upon their value as wild areas for human use. I mean, it was explained as places where people could engage in recreation or other human activity. So it wasn't protecting them from people. It was protecting particular types
for
of human
people,
activity.
Yeah.
that would otherwise disappear. But your other question, though, about our shift in the way we have thought about land, that I think has taken place over a much longer period of time. This notion that nature is fundamentally a collection of natural resources, that we can fragment it into pieces, that we value it chiefly for our ability to either sell the piece of nature in the market or to sell what we take from it in the market. If we go back 500 or 1,000 years ago, of course, the thinking about land was vastly different. And it was vastly different in much of early America as well. When people looked at land, it was much more in terms of their use value, as a suitability, as a place to live, a place to root a family, to root a community. There was vastly less attention that was paid to market values or even the ability of people to take things from the land and to market them. But so it's been sort of a slow development. The 19th century saw an awful lot of change here with the commodification of nature. There have been environmental historians, I might add, who have tried to generalize about our interactions with the continent in the United States since the early 17th century. And a number of them have said that probably the predominant factor that has explained how we interact with nature for good and ill has been our tendency to treat nature as commodities, to fragment it into pieces of land, to sever nature and to evaluate the value of the parts based upon their marketability. Of course, in this mentality, the vast majority of nature's parts are worthless, and we sort of act like we can just throw them away. Either you can use something directly, or you can sell it, or it is useless. And of course, that runs very much contrary to ecological wisdom. As we're gradually seeing, I mean, there has been very much a counter-reaction to this notion of nature as a fragmented group of commodities. I mean, that's what the call for ecological consideration is about, the recognition that we are ultimately dependent upon the land's ecological functioning, and that lots of parts of nature that might not have direct value to us are quite valuable because of the role they play in things like sustaining soil fertility and keeping soil in place and keeping water flows clean and keeping water cycles reasonably predictable and so on. So, the fragmentation of nature has been a huge problem. I actually thought in your question that you were going to head in a somewhat different direction, and that is the more intellectual fragmentation that has taken place in our society, particularly over the last few decades. The specialization of academic fields, the specialization of work and knowledge. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why the conservation movement itself has trouble articulating larger visions of humans and nature, and has trouble talking about our predicament generally, is because everybody in our society has trouble. We just are losing the ability to talk about the big picture of our existence in sensible ways that take into account nature and culture and institutions and values. I mean, we need more people who can talk about our larger predicament and who can think about it clearly in those terms. And unfortunately, we've sort of drifted into an age of just complete specialization where people know a lot about a little, but can't really talk sensibly about the larger whole.
Yeah. I wonder if that way of compartmentalizing things is kind of a struggle to make sense of the world, a very complex world. The big picture is big. I marvel at what's in my backyard. I mean, that little piece of landscape that I...
You could study your backyard forever and still not know it.
Yeah. And, here we can go back to Wanted, an environmental leader. One of the things that made me smile in that essay is that you list, the assets that a strong candidate will bring to the table, and that includes a grasp of the human predicament. And fragmentation is part of that predicament, and so is ignorance and denial. And also in this little part of the essay, you also say something I think that is very important, that the strong candidate is not going to disrespect the people who he or she will lead.
Right. I mean, there's got to be some way to speak to people that engages them, that draws them in. And it's not easily done when, at the same time that you're respecting them and drawing them in, you really believe on the inside, in your heart and mind, that these people have to become quite different than they are, that they've got to see the world differently, that they've got to have different aesthetic preferences, they've got to value connections when they, in the past, they've tended to see nature in fragmented terms. They've got to understand the need for us collectively to make decisions about how we use nature instead of giving people extensive individual liberty. They've got to come up with new ways of thinking about private property. They need to lessen their sort of faith in science. They've got to come to terms with really what we can expect the market to do and what we can't, expect it to do. I think one of the failings of our education system today is that we don't really help people understand critically the major components of the world in which we live. I mean, people who graduate from a place like the University of Illinois ought to be able to talk sensibly about the strengths and limitations of science, for instance, and about what we can expect the market to do and what we can't expect it to do, and about some of the downsides of a world in which we as individuals are chiefly producers and consumers and united in the market. I mean, what are some of the complications with that? But I mean, this has been a problem, I think, for serious conservation writers for decades, is this realization that we've got to speak to people in a way that draws them in and respects them and gets them engaged and interested. But at the same time, frankly, I think that we collectively need to become much different people. If we are having severe problems in interacting with nature, as I believe we are, many of them are not well known. I mean, it's interesting to me that global climate change has drawn so much attention, but there's frankly three or four other issues which are every bit as frightening to me, which are almost completely off the radar screen at the moment, just as climate change was 20 years ago. But if we really are going to live better on Earth, we have got to become different people. I mean, that takes me back to the first question you asked and my response to it. There's nothing wrong with nature. The problems are all in the way we live on the land. The way we live on the land has a lot to do with our culture, with our social relations, with our perceptions, with our moral values. I mean, we take it for granted, for instance, that people have vast moral value and that nothing else in the universe does have moral value. You know, no other life is morally worthy. Only humans have value. Well, there's reasons why we treat humans as special, but maybe we ought to pause there and think about this a little bit more. You know, is the line between human life and all other life really that stark? I mean, when the people who say, I'm pro-life, is it really plausible to say I'm in favor of all forms of human life and don't really care about all other living things? So there's a lot of questions, I think, that we need to be asking. And it's certainly one of the challenges for any conservation leader would be to raise these issues in a way that help people see the importance of them, that provoke them to ask serious questions, but at the same time that where you're not alienating the listeners.
Mm. Eric Freifogel is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of law and an affiliate professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His most recent book is Agrarianism and the Good Society, Land, Culture, Conflict, and Hope. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, in terms of going back to this idea of a desire to be engaged, to be inspired, maybe you would talk with us here about another essay that you have in this book, Eric. You explore the novel Wendell Berry's novel. And maybe you would tell us about the character that gives the book its title.
I should say that Wendell Berry, the author of this novel, is I think, far and away our leading agrarian writer of our generation. He is a farmer, mostly a writer, but a part-time farmer in north central Kentucky, and has really written, oh goodness, maybe 40-some books at the time. He is very widely admired by serious conservationists, I mean, that is, those who take a lot of time to read and reflect upon our larger predicament. And I think a lot of this resurgence of interest in agrarianism as a concept, as a strand of conservation thought, has a lot to do with his work. Agrarianism, by the way, I would say is a term that needs to be treated with some care because it has meant a lot of things to a lot of people at different times. The way I use it, the way it is being used by conservationists today, is to talk about a strand of conservation that really focuses on landscapes where people are living and working, and that really tries to focus on establishing strong links between people and place in their daily lives and in their working lives. So it's farms and forests and towns and the like. So it is as opposed to the strand of conservation thought that focuses on human health, which is probably had been the dominant one. You know, our air that we breathe, the water we drink, the food. I mean, so much of our work has been focused on direct dangers to human health. And then we do, of course, have the strand of conservation thought that you referred to earlier about protecting wilderness areas and wild species, the sort of wildness protection. So in a sense, agrarianism is the third part. But in this book, which is sort of loosely based upon the place where Wendell Berry lives, he tells the story of this town barber, born the day before World War I starts. He goes away for a while to school, living in various places, comes back to this very small, fading town of Port William, fictional town of Port William, Kentucky, to sort of take up the life of being a small-town barber under very poor circumstances. And he sort of lives with the community then for some decades. I think that Berry, in his fiction, tries to come to terms with our human predicament on the land and in places like this fictional Port William. And he tries to get us to see the struggles involved with living well and to illustrate some of the successes and failures of people in living well. And I think in Berry's fictional work, not just in this but others, that he often portrays some people in this fictional community as being ideal characters or as being strong, admirable characters, people who care about the land, who've got the kind of virtues and values that Berry thinks are suitable for maintaining good living on the land. The problem that I raise in my essay that's focused on this novel, Jay Burke Crow, has to do really with what I take to be the excessive individualism of these characters. Yes, they're attentive to the land. Yes, they want to protect it. Yes, they're worried about its degradation. They understand that people need to work together to develop the kind of knowledge about good land use that's required for the land tenders to use the land. Well, they've got long temporal perspectives. They're not just thinking about today. They're thinking about generations to come. They want their communities to last. They want their land use practices to survive. All of their values are in place. The thing that I believe is missing, though, is that they just don't understand what it's going to take for people in towns like this to defend themselves against the outside forces that are pressing down so hard. The theme of his book is that if we would just love one another, if we would really respect and care for one another, then maybe all would be well. It's a very distinctly Christian message, of course. But my point is we really need to be getting together collectively as citizens, as Democrats, and taking matters into our own hands. And as long as we sort of sit back and just try to live good, clean lives individually, they're just I don't think that there's that much hope.
Yeah. You're speaking of small D Democrat?
Yes. Oh, sure.
Small R Republican?
Oh, absolutely.
Active citizenship is what you're
after. I think we need more active citizenship. That is, a lot of the... Well, another way to come at this is that a lot of people want to know, what can I do in my personal life? You know, how can I change things individually to make a difference in our environmental plight? And there certainly are some things that can be done. I actually, though, am one who is strongly of the view that we need to change the system. That there are, obviously one of the complaints in many settings is people don't accept responsibility themselves, they blame the system. Well, I think in this setting, we ought to be blaming the system.
Yeah.
There are a lot of forces that people just cannot control in their daily lives, and unless we organize to make some systemic changes, we're not going to make progress.
We've got a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you, so let's go first to Danville, a listener on line 4. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank
Hi.
You. A couple of things. Number one, you mentioned the decline in, of people being enthusiastic about ecology and so forth, and I wonder if some of that might have to do with the fact that the mass migration that took place of rural people into the urban setting over the last 150 years is pretty much complete now. I mean, we're an urbanized society. People who had close contact with the land no longer do. even the farmers themselves. I mean, sit in air-conditioned vehicles all day long and climb out of that into an air-conditioned truck to go to an air-conditioned home. They really don't come in contact any longer, and those are the farmers. You know, then you have the urbanites who are even more removed from all of this. And when you have a cocooning society, I wonder how much that contributes to, oh, well, you know, the environment is out there. I don't have to worry about it.
Sure. Surely you must be, what you say must be true. I mean, the environmental sensibility has sort of waxed and waned over the last 30 or 40 years, and there have been times when public sentiment was more aroused. But I think your point is well taken, that I think when the sentiment has been aroused, it has often been about public health threats that people feel even when they're living in the city. The food they're getting is contaminated. The air they're breathing is contaminated. It's been much harder for them to pay attention, as you suggest, to land use issues, to the things that agrarianism is aimed at, to the fundamental ecological cycles. The urbanization of people, and I suppose I would add to that today just their distraction, the number of things to distract people, you know, the ease with which people retreat into virtual reality and look at computer screens and so on.
Right, so there's no more
makes it hard. That's exactly right.
The other thing, too, verbiage. And it really came home this last week. I attended a meeting that a power company executive was talking about their future plans, and it was a room predominantly full of rural people, and he used the term, you know, they were talking about a plant and so forth, and he was talking about the ecological impact of it and the verbiage that is used. Ecology has, you know, the people who support ecological sustainability have almost been demonized through the years. You know, and it's hard. In fact, I asked the question, okay, what were the health concerns that the environmentalist, because he used the term environmentalist, and when he used that term, you could just hear everybody in the room go, you know.
Sure.
And I asked the question, well, what were the health concerns? And he couldn't understand my question. And I said, well, you said the ecologists had gotten old. And he had a tough time kind of wrapping around the concept that there was a health concern involved. And I just wonder how much of the demonization, the verbalization that is used on both sides of all these issues doesn't actually make it more difficult to come to a synergy on the entire issues.
Oh, indeed. It sure does. Comment about the response to the term environmentalist, of course, is a familiar one. I guess I would say that I think that the reason why people react negatively to the term environmentalist is because their image of environmentalism is shaped almost entirely by critics. They hear things from critics, they sink in, they seem plausible, they believe them, and frankly, they hear almost nothing from environmentalists. I mean, literally, is the case. You would sort of think about the common image of the environmentalist, you wouldn't know that the vast bulk of all environmental work is aimed at protecting human health. It is not protecting nature from people. It is the air we breathe. It's the water we drink. It's the food. I mean, in a state particularly such as Illinois, that's about 95% of it all. Like, you can almost criticize the environmental movement for being much too focused on the welfare of people living today. But more generally, though, it is a failing, I think, of the environmental movement for not having a voice and not having a larger vision. And you mentioned the word health. When people think of that, they almost immediately think about the health of individual humans in isolation. You know, individual humans are healthy. That's what health, by definition, means. And it's a flaw because so much of our long-term welfare is dependent upon the natural settings where we live and their ecological functioning. And it's a shame that wonderfully powerful term health hasn't been grabbed onto by the environmental or conservation movement and used to talk about things above the level of the individual human. We're embedded in landscapes. Landscapes can be more or less healthy. I mean, this was the little conservation litany that Ole Leopold used late in his life. He would explain to people, land really is a community of life, of plants and animals, soils, waters, and so on, including people. This community, as such, can be more or less healthy. Conservation is about the health of the land community. That's what we're about. We're a healthcare effort, but it's not the health of individuals in isolation. It's a health movement that realizes, ultimately, our welfare is tied up with the healthy functioning of the land. So,
I want to thank
There's a lot of failings that are wrapped up in that little story you've just told.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to Tara Holt, a listener on line one. Hi.
Yes. Hello?
Hi there. Go ahead.
Earlier, you mentioned that a couple other things that you found just as frightening as global climate change. I was wondering if you could maybe expand on that, please. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for that. Thanks for that that question. Yeah, that we left that on the table, didn't we?
Sure. You know, that global climate change is of a different order of pollution problem than the others because, to a large extent, it just involves carbon dioxide, which it's hard for us to think of that as a pollutant. What it really is just a fundamental element in nature. And we are disturbing natural balances in this fundamental element. As far as I can tell, there is a growing and almost equal concern these days about the way we have altered balances of nitrogen and phosphorus in our systems, particularly in our farming methods. You know, we use natural gas, turn it into anhydrous ammonia. We're interjecting it into systems. We are grossly overloading natural systems in terms of the nitrogen and, to a lesser extent, the phosphorus in them. And we are increasingly now realizing the massive ecological problems that are coming about as a result of that. So I would put that one pretty high up on the list. What many people might well start with is simply the biological disruption in our landscapes, the fact that we are removing lots and lots of species from places where they used to live and moving species from one place to another, what are often referred to as exotics that are coming in, this sort of biological mixing and biological soup that is taking place with a lot of bad consequences in many respects. Although I will quickly say that one of the challenges of trying to make sense out of this biological mixing is to figure out what kind of changes are good, which ones are bad, and which ones are just plain changes, and it's hard to know whether they really are good or bad. But if we were to sort of go back in time, looking at the way natural systems functioned before humans altered them very much, we would be impressed, for instance, by the fact that fertility cycles all worked in circular ways. You know, the land sort of sustained its own fertility. Well, we have largely now in our farmlands, and again, Illinois is a good example, most of Illinois, have shifted to linear fertility systems where we import fertilizers, we take crops from the field, and they are gone. Well, that system obviously is not sustainable forever because you've got limited supplies of the fertilizer that you're bringing in. There's a lot of ill effects to it. But if we were to think about shifting back to a system based on circular fertility, suddenly we would need a lot of these biological parts. I mean, again, I've made several references to Aldo Leopold here. His main argument for why we need to save nature's parts in a place, its plants and animals, is because they play roles in maintaining the soil's fertility, keeping it in place, keeping it productive over time. I mean, I would put this biological soup on the list as well. Another thing I would put it right up there, frankly, would be the condition of our soils. What do they say? Iowa has lost half of its topsoil, and it continues to wash away. Illinois has lost a fair amount as well. I don't know what the best guess is there. It's not just a question of gradual soil erosion. I mean, today, if we sort of get soil erosion down to the point where we're only losing it over a 500-year time frame or something, we would say, oh, well, that's okay. You know, we don't need to worry about 500 years. But our soils are deteriorating, and I don't know that we really have sort of confessed to what we are doing to our soils with our contemporary agricultural methods. I mean, certainly the organic content of them is way below what it ought to be. Are they slowly washing away? Are we slowly degrading them in a way that's, you know, going to have very long-term ill effects? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that anybody knows an answer, but I'm alarmed that we're not asking the question and probing it a little more. So I would say just concerns about soil in place, soil fertility. And as conservationists have often said over a long period of time, if you keep all of the soils in place and can keep them fertile, you can bring back the plants and animals, I mean, as long as they haven't literally disappeared. You can rebuild ecological communities. But if your soil is gone, as it's been gone in many parts of the world, and really been destroyed, you've got big troubles. We cannot understand the war in Iraq right now without understanding what's happened to the soils in that part of the world. And that's true of other, you know, problems elsewhere. There are lots of parts of the world where the soils have been degraded and life has suffered because of it. So anyway, I could go on, but I probably rambled too much.
Back to, we're here, we just have a couple minutes left. Back to Aldo Leopold, maybe you would talk a little bit more, flesh this out for us, his thinking about interconnectedness and land health. And I can only, like, you know, give you about 2-3 minutes.
That's quite all right. Well,
it's a big question.
Sure. Sure, it is. I mean, Aldo Leopold, writing in the 30s and 40s, was very painfully aware of fragmentation within the conservation effort of his day. He defined the term conservation pretty broadly to include people who were professional foresters and grazers and wildlife experts, people who were promoting various resource uses. He said, "We are giving landowners conflicting advice. We're pushing them in different directions. Our efforts are not really orchestrated. If we really are going to make progress, we need an overall goal of some sort that we can all aim for, and we can evaluate our contributions to conservation based upon how well we have succeeded in promoting that goal." He came up with a goal called land health. It took him a long time to do it because he really had to figure out the basics of how land worked. He also wanted to think some about human uses and human values and what we needed the land to do in order for us to live ourselves. Even late in his life, he didn't really feel like he could explain land health very thoroughly. It was a bit like human health. The doctors have a much easier time identifying signs of sickness, land sickness, he said. For a long time, he said, here are some signs of land sickness. Inevitably, when he talked about land sickness, the number one symptom he pointed to was we're losing soil, or the soil is declining in fertility. The nutrient cycles are being interrupted. They're being shortened. Nutrients are washing away sooner than they should. The land is losing its overall capacity to be productive. That was number one. Another sign that he often gave, often number two on his list, was alterations of hydrologic systems, flooding that was unnatural, droughts that were unnatural. He pointed also to the disappearance of species in a place without visible cause, or the what he called eruption of species into pest status. We have a lot of wildlife. We have a lot of wildlife pests these days. A lot of people don't think of them. They don't think of white-tailed deer or Canada geese or something as pests, but they really are. I mean, their numbers are way too high. And although people might be encouraged by that, they say, oh, look at all this wildlife that's out there. Well, the problem is that for every species like that where the numbers are up, we've got 10 or 20 where they're down. And often a thing like Canada geese, when it comes in, when their numbers erupt, we need to stop and say, well, what about all the other, you know, waterfowl species that used to be here and aren't around much?
Yeah. What's happening? Or they've moved around and they're in places where they shouldn't be.
They could be. They could be. But we have a lot of species that, you know, ought to be common in places like central Illinois but have gone. I mean, people don't realize, for instance, that with changes in farming practices over the last 75 years or so, we have suffered declines in various grassland nesting birds of well upwards of 90%. Birds that used to be very common are now quite scarce. I mean, I think somebody told me not long ago that Illinois doesn't even have anybody, the state doesn't have anybody who works on bobwhite quail anymore as a game species, because we have so little quail habitat and so few quail in the whole state, for heaven's sakes. But I mean, even things like eastern meadowlark, the populations are down over 90%. And things like, you know, Henslow sparrow is now on the endangered species.
Well, you know, here's what somebody might say, though. You know, it's an economic reality, and we're stuck. And I can give you now, 1 minute.
Sure. Well, I guess my response there would be, before we reach that conclusion, why don't we spend some time looking at alternatives? Why don't we think about what the alternatives are out there? Could we be using our landscapes in much different ways? I think the answer is very plainly yes. Oh, good heavens, yes. We could be making radical changes to our landscape that would improve them ecologically. There's no reason, for instance, why we need to be growing so much corn and shipping it across the country and feeding it to beef cattle to raise beef that way. It would be vastly better ecologically if we put the cattle back on the land and had pastures, because pastures, of course, the grass is in place, the land is covered, soil erosion goes down dramatically, it improves water hydrologic cycles. The ecological benefits are many, their value as wildlife habitat can go up substantially. There's a lot of changes that could take place. You know, our main problem in agriculture in this country since 1920 has been overproduction, massive overproduction. And frankly, the main reason we push ethanol is not because it's much of an energy source. It really isn't. It's being wildly oversold for that reason. Ethanol from corn, by the way. I mean, getting ethanol from sugarcane or something is an entirely different story. And biofuels is an idea, has a lot of merit, but not from corn the way we grow corn in Illinois. But the main reason we promote ethanol is simply a way to get rid of excess corn production. We get rid of, what, more than one-fourth of Illinois corn crop into ethanol in order to recover the energy mostly that we've spent just producing the corn and processing it into ethanol. I mean, there is some slight gain there, but and there's a great deal of uncertainty about how much that is. But our problem has been overproduction. We could easily diminish the corn production in Illinois massively and have a lot of environmental benefits from it without at all interfering with their food production.
There we have to leave it. We are out of time. Eric Freifogel, thanks for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for calling.
You're very welcome. Eric Freifogel is the author most recently of Agrarianism and the Good Society, Land, Culture, Conflict, and Hope. The book is published by the University Press of Kentucky.